It ain't that simple, mate.
Hello and welcome to It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast, where we talk about missions and poverty and everything related to those subjects. And I'm Fraser Scott.
And I'm Kevin Honoree.
Here to talk about season three, which is pretty exciting, Kevin. We're finally back after a long hiatus to talk about some different things. And of course, in the gap that we've had, what was that thing called? COVID?
C19 or something?
Yeah, I've basically already blocked it out of my memory.
Yeah, I think most people have.
I'm certainly trying to.
Yes.
And so we have, if you haven't heard our old podcast, go back and have a listen to them. We talk about the foundations for Bright Hope World, our values, what we believe, kind of what we do. And, you know, we don't like to outstay our welcome. So we took a wee break to focus on working with our partners during COVID. And then decided, well, we'd like to come back and talk about some of the things that we've seen and experienced during COVID, how the world is changing, the trends and challenges that we see out there. And we thought, well, what would be a good structure to do that? And so what we decided we would do is kind of look through the different, in season three, the different categories of partnership that we have. And if you look on our website, you can look up the partners that we have in each of these categories. But they are, broadly speaking, humanitarian and relief partnerships, and that's what we're going to talk about today. We also have orphans and vulnerable children, microenterprise and microloans, that's a big one for us, training and education, evangelism and church planting, and then agriculture and community development, which are also huge for us.
Yeah.
So we're going to start today, Kev, with humanitarian and relief stuff. Now, if you're at all familiar with Bright Hope World, you may think it's odd that we're starting there because we don't really do relief as a rule and the humanitarian stuff. I mean, we do some of that, but it's not really our focus. So why start here? What do these things mean, and why would we start here, Kev?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a lot of reasons for that. One is there's stuff happening all the time. There's stuff happening where our partners live all the time. And so it does create opportunity. You know, we have this little mantra that aid and humanitarian work is short-term stuff. But it does lead often into other longer term stuff that we can get involved in. So
but maybe just because we're assuming some knowledge here and we're just barging into the subject, but we don't tend to do relief. And before we sort of talk of the space, like, why not? You know, when there's a disaster, there's an earthquake. We've just had a big one of those in Syria. We've of course had one in Christchurch in the past, but it's a different story. Or there's war. You know, all of these things that disrupt, and we tend not to be Johnny on the spot. Why not?
There's a couple of big reasons. One is we're set up more for the longer term ongoing development of people. Aid and humanitarian relief requires large amounts of money from specialist kind of people and organizations with the ability to act quickly, jump in there and kind of drive in and rescue and then rehabilitate people. So we're just not geared up for that. We're too small for that. It's not our spot. And so when we, you know, are involved or do get involved, it's no criticism of people that, and we talk about this, there's no negative connotations towards organisations that are set up for that purpose. It's absolutely essential. And we've seen that in New Zealand just recently with floods and floods over in Hawke's Bay, you know. I mean, that was months ago and it's still going on, still requiring lots of people, lots of resource and quick action. And we're just not geared up for that. So it's not our sweet spot, really. I guess that's the best way to explain it.
So what is relief? You know, let's start on negative and we'll work our way towards positive. What does relief look like when it's not done particularly well? And again, let's say this so we don't have to keep saying it. We're not pointing the finger at anyone. Often these are decisions made under very difficult circumstances. But when one has the opportunity to look back and reflect, what are the mistakes one can make in the relief space?
Well, you don't have to go too far afield to know if you notice a few. The biggest issue around this is the mindset that you go in with. And let's point out a glaring issue or a glaring place in this space. Haiti, for example, where, you know, billions of dollars have gone in there for relief effort after relief effort for multiple reasons, but, you know, just and the whole place is just a nightmare because people have gone in with goodwill, but with strategies that are flawed. And so you just put layer upon layer upon layer of the wrong kind of intervention, and you produce a real disaster that it's almost, I mean, people are saying we've got to the point where there's no way to solve it. It's, so what do you do then? Do you just walk away, or do you keep funding it, or, you know, a whole series of other potential bad decisions we made around it, that type of thing.
What you see in a lot of the places that we go is containers of things, big shipping containers full of stuff arriving. And it might be T-shirts, it might be bicycles, it might be food.
Shoes,
of course. and, you know, we have partners who have storehouses full of things that maybe aren't that useful. I recall a partner telling us, you know, where they had received a container full of bottled water. And they paid significantly more to clear that container through customs than it would have been to just go and buy the bottled water in the local market. Why do we respond like this? Is this a heart thing? Because it is well-intentioned. Is it a heart thing rather than a head thing that's going on?
Yeah, well, we're all humans, let's face it. So you see somebody in need and you want to do something. Coming at it from a Christian point of view, there's compassion in there, there's grace in there, there's all sorts of, you know, noble reasons why we would get involved. But they can't trump the need for strategic and clear thinking when you go into a place, and not to be driving it from outside. So, you know, we sit out here and we say, oh, they're going to need this, so we just dump this in there. And who's to say they need this? People that are involved in aid are in a terrible situation in terms of decision making. I mean, you've got to do something. But doing the wrong thing, or even the right thing at the wrong time, can just multiply the problem, not deal with it. So one of the problems with disaster is that you don't know where it's going to occur and when. And so how do you prepare well for that? But, you know, in many cases, the last thing we need is well-intentioned people sort of jumping in, running in there and running around doing their thing. We do need to engage with those who are the professionals at it and steer clear from it. And so, you know, for people like us, we just, in a sense, stay away from that space unless we've got people on the ground who can do something, you know, with it. And right. That's the other side of the discussion.
Right. So the very first time I heard about Bright Hope World back in, would have been the beginning of 2005, mm-hmm. and this was after the big Asian tsunami, mm-hmm. and listened to Rob Dewitt Church talking about the fact that the people on the ground, connected through churches, had said, boy, what we really need is to repair our fishing boats and our fishing nets so we can just go out and look after our own needs, which immediately caught my attention. I thought, well, that's a very good way to do it, and so that was what was helped with, and the people were able to stand on their feet. Is that a typical way that, you know, we would respond to a relief requirement?
Yeah, pretty much. I can't really think of a situation where we wouldn't go in at the behest of an existing partner. Probably almost the closest would have been the last time we did it in Syria, where somebody, a neighbouring country in Lebanon, somebody who had close contacts in Syria, we were able to deliver some help into families and kids that had lost everything, including their parents and siblings and all that. But that was because we had somebody nearby who intimately knew the situation and was able to intervene, even though we don't have any partners in Syria. But yeah, we've done this a number of times, but every time with an existing partner. So like Nepal, 2015. Involved there with Naranjan Adhikari, and even in that case, you know, it was immediate, but it was focused. So for example, his idea was to provide temporary shelter for people who'd lost everything, to give them a place to live while they rebuilt their homes, And so money was given, and it was sent, and he said, "Well, we don't need any more. We've done all we can do."
I remember that, and we'd been given funds by a British trust for relief, and he said, "I don't want these."
Yeah.
And back they went, and they didn't quite know what to do with that. They'd never experienced that situation before.
Yeah.
So his emphasis then is, you know, when we talk about the timeframes and the process of development, one moves from the relief situation to rehabilitation, to starting to rebuild infrastructure, rebuild community. We would probably tend to jump in more at that point.
Yeah, very much so, and that's been the case in most of these places. I mean, in some cases, like for example, Pakistan, have had a couple of floods. Was a big one in 2012, and we sent some funds to our partners who could go down and just give food to people who were living on the roads, because the roads are built up on, just above the floodplains, and so people were living along the roads. Everything was flooded out, so they were able to deliver some food and that type of stuff. But the real bit where it became, you know, really helpful was then to start rebuilding their houses. So they would collect all the old bricks up from around the place, and for about $800, they could rebuild somebody's house. And that's where most of our kind of, if you like, aid or rehabilitation funding went in that case.
Let me ask. I'm going to really put you on the spot with a difficult question that you're not going to want to answer.
Thanks, Fraser.
Lord forbid, another disaster comes along, and it's in a country where Bright Hope World doesn't have a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And someone comes to you and says, "Kev, I want to give some funds to this particular disaster. Does Bright Hope World have a partner?" "No, we don't." Well, then how would I do that? How would I support an organisation that's working in that space? What are the questions I should be asking? How do I know how to support this? Because, you know, we're moved by these situations, and rightly so. We want to help. How do we help in a practical way if it's not through the wonderful means of Bright Hope World?
Oh, you could give it to Bright Hope. We'll send you over there, Fraser, on a helicopter, and you could deliver it, you know, put it out there, and away you go. But no, I think, you know, it's really important to give through organisations that are established on the ground. So one of the things that really annoys us from time to time is where something will happen, an event, and an organisation that doesn't do that kind of stuff puts out an appeal and says, "Hey, look, give us money, we can deliver it there for you." And it's like, nah, that's not how it works. You haven't got the capacity on the ground at that end to do what's required. So just really find people on the ground that have the capacity to do it. Now, I think one of the problems you have is that many of the agencies that are out there are so linked in with governments and countries and all that kind of stuff that it's hard to know how much of the money will get to where it needs to go and how quickly it'll get there. And I think, you know, even in New Zealand with this Hawke's Bay thing, I mean, money was given months ago to help, and it still hasn't been doled out because it's got tangled up in the bureaucracy of the organisation it was given to, but then the agency that was supposed to perhaps deliver it. And so work out really clearly, carefully, how can we get that there best, the most of it there as quickly as possible, and delivered as strategically as possible.
So let me summarise that. You want to be making sure that things are being led from the ground. There's people on the ground that are directing it. It's not being directed from back here or the US or the UK or wherever.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that the money is getting to the maximum amount. Is it right to ask what percentage of the money actually reaches the people on the ground?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. It'd be one of the first questions you would ask, I would think. Yeah, how's it going to get there? How quickly? And what's it going to cost? I mean, to get it there. There's lots of ways it can just, you know, get bunged up and not get there.
And is there a place for sending containers of stuff?
If that's what's required from that end. You know, if there's a disaster, I mean, we don't know. You've got to deal with the experts on that stuff. I mean, you can't sit back here and say, "Oh, we need to send blankets to Nepal and know whether that's what's required there. Can you get it there? What's it going to cost to get it there?" So if you're going to send a container, send all the money to send the container as well. You know,
And look, while we're talking about this, it's probably worth noting our general advice on this, not just in a relief situation, but any time a container of anything is being sent, is if those things can be purchased in the local country, in the local markets, you will support people twice.
Yeah.
And if you send things and dump a whole bunch of bicycles or shoes or whatever into a place where those products are already for sale, you will kill the local market for those products. So think very carefully about doing it.
It's really funny you say that, because I was just talking to somebody yesterday and talking about going to a place where there's been frequent disasters, Mozambique. And there's floods there every second week by the sound of it, and hurricanes and all sorts of stuff. And so, you know, the person that I was talking to said, oh, yeah, I was talking to people at work about that. And they said, oh, man, we should run around and get all of our old glasses and blankets and shoes and send them all off with you. It's like, what? Why would you do that? I mean, it's like, it's a nice thought. But this is one of the problems we face here, as Westerners particularly. We're problem solvers and we want to jump in there and do something. But we do have to think before we jump and think carefully and do the research and talk to the right people, that sort of stuff.
And assume our ideas are not going to work until we're told otherwise.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, let's move on from relief for a moment. You know, we've talked about this category being humanitarian and relief. And we'll take a break in a few minutes and come back and talk about refugees, because that's a whole nother category that sort of fits in here as well. But let's just talk about humanitarian work. What does that mean? It's a very broad category. What are some of the examples of the sort of things that we might call humanitarian?
Yeah, well, I mean, as everyone will know, is if they've listened to any of our stuff, that for us, it's not just about the physical. We're talking about helping people spiritually and physically, economically, you know, the whole person. And when we refer to humanitarian, we're really talking about an aid situation where it's an immediate, quick response required that maybe doesn't even have the opportunity to deliver the other aspects of the whole person, almost like a knee-jerk reaction to a specific issue that is largely physical in nature. Now, we've got a number of partners where that is happening, and we have engaged there with the spiritual component of it is a little more difficult to identify how that can be delivered. But we have to, we have to go back to Jesus in this thing, because you see him frequently being moved with compassion because of the plight of somebody. And when you first engage, you don't always know what the opportunity will be for the rest of the story or the rest of the piece. And we are all humans, after all. And so every person is, retains the image of God and is a special creation of God. And so, there is a compelling aspect to just getting involved. And like I said, you can't always see what the steps following that might be. So I'm just thinking, for example, as a partner in South Africa, where back when the AIDS was really going off, they were just going around finding people in their homes and helping them. They didn't know whether people wanted spiritual help, but they certainly needed someone to come alongside them and help them get their medication. And that developed, and it's now gone into other components of helping people, like training people about how to look after AIDS patients in their home. It's gone onto schools to warn people about how to manage their relationships and their sexuality and all that, so that they're not exposed to AIDS. Then the spiritual dimension comes through as well. So that,
it's a good sort of, I think, counter to, how we tend to operate as an organization, very strategic, and we're looking for the big kingdom return on investment, and we're looking for the stuff that has the potential to be self-sustaining. We could see it is, step out of that. But this is that category of partners that it is really hard stuff. It's very human stuff.
And compassion is the thing. I've also, somebody's explained compassion as love with its sleeves rolled up. So where you're compelled out of love, out of your Christian convictions to do something, to move towards in that situation. So I'm thinking of like T. Raja and Bangalore.
The obvious one, yeah.
Craziest guy, but just the most magnificent man. And, you know, I just saw some figures. Over 5,000 people now have been cared for by him and his organization. And they just he just picks up people off the street and doesn't know who they are, doesn't know where they come from, doesn't know what you know, what will eventuate. In most cases, these people die. But for him, the byline is, you know, helping people experience the love of Christ at least once in their lives before they die, and to bury people with dignity, you know. So it's like, well, can't argue with that. Yeah, it's worth getting behind something like that. In many cases, and as the story has gone on, hundreds of people have become believers from that. Hundreds of people have been rehabilitated back into society and married and having children, and life starts all over again for these like bags of human detritus that he picks up off the street. So yeah, hard to know. You just can't not go there.
And it seems, you know, as I think through the partners that we have that sit in that category, often it's less the sort of, you know, the strategic nature of the work. It's just the hearts of the people doing the work are just so compelling that you get sort of drawn along with it, don't you? You know, they're amazing, big-hearted people that work in that humanitarian
space. And you know that, you know, it's the old story. If you've got the right person in the room, or you're in partnership with the right person, there'll be some great outcomes from that, because these are the people who often don't think through what is this going to look like in 10 years. They respond, but you know they have the capacity to follow through and deliver all that's required to minister to the whole person. So you're not just you're dealing with great people on the ground that can access what's required at the right time for those people. Yeah, you know their hearts. You know that they're not just there to for the money or for other reasons. Their motives are right, and so they'll do good stuff with those people, and you jump in there. You can't always say what's going to look like in 5 years from now, but
no. All right, let's take a break there. When we come back, we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about refugees. This is sort of an unstated element of our partnership category here of humanitarian and relief. So we will be back very shortly on It Ain't That Simple, Mate. It Ain't That Simple, Mate is brought to you by Lamai Coffee. Lamai Coffee is the finest quality organic Arabica coffee from the northern hills of Thailand. We at Bright Hope World import the green beans into New Zealand, and we roast them to perfection, then sell them to discerning coffee drinkers. We're all volunteers on the team, so all the profits go back into great community projects in Thailand. And that is why we call it the world's best tasting act of kindness. You can order Lamai Coffee or find out more at lamai.co.nz.
It ain't that simple, mate.
Welcome back to It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast, where we are exploring different types of Bright Hope World partnerships. And today we are looking at our humanitarian and relief partnerships, which also includes the work that we do with refugees, which is sadly a growing area. And just to set the scene a little bit, looking up some stats, there are somewhere around 100 million refugees in the world today. And about, including about 53 million internally displaced people, or IDPs as they're often referred to. And to give that some context, this is a higher number of refugees than was seen at the height of World War II. So it's a pretty serious and a staggering issue. Kev, what's behind all this? Is this war? Is it, you know, we hear about climate refugees. What is going on around the world that is seeing so many people having to leave their homes and travel?
Yeah, I mean, there are some big drivers. It's really interesting from a Christian point of view, if you look back, that, you know, refugees have always been, they've always been with us, right back through the Old Testament and that. and most of the same reasons throughout human history are what produce refugees. I mean, I went on to the Global Citizen website to have a look at some of this, and four or five big ones are persecution, whether that's religious, social, racial, or political. That's the most common. So some kind of persecution. Really interesting, the other day I was just coming back into the country and there were people coming into New Zealand from Eritrea. They were at the airport collecting their bags, people there to meet them, and coming out of a plane. That was a persecution situation. I talked with the father of the guys there, and that's what drove them out of Eritrea.
Just on that, and this is a slight sideline, it's more my own thought. Are we seeing a rise in persecution? Is this something that's always been there in the background, or in the foreground if you're experiencing it? Or are we actually seeing a significant rise in persecution around the world?
It's the biggest one now, right across the board, according to these guys. There seems to be like weaponizing religious differences in several major countries and parts of the world where countries are moving towards more extreme or the politicization of religious difference. I don't want to mention the countries now for the sake of our partners there, but you know, some that were quite open in the past are now increasingly more difficult for Christians to live in. There's parts of the world where it's not Christians that have been kicked out, it's others. So yeah, it's happening all around.
So just to go down the rabbit hole just for a moment, you know, do we see this as a, you know, rise in nationalism that's you know, causing this? As you know, what's changing in the world that causes the open to become closed? Is it just trends, or?
I think there is a global trend towards, there's a sort of self-protection thing in there, or protecting my tribe kind of thing on a national scale. So you're talking, you know, in some cases hundreds of millions of people, and it's always been there to some degree. I remember way back in the day when we lived in Zambia, you know, the neighbouring country Zimbabwe had basically two tribes. One was always going to be larger than the other, so the minority was always, and so those guys after they got independence, the minority group, a lot of those people started to move out because they knew there was not much future there for them. They wouldn't be able to live there with the freedom that they wanted. There would always be some kind of persecution going on, and so whenever there's an internal strife. We see what's happening in Sudan right now, you know, it's like people are being persecuted. A lot of towards the end of last year, we were in Egypt and huge numbers of Sudanese people there already, a lot of them Christian Sudanese who just had to leave because of the situation. And in this case, you know, they were facing religious persecution. And it's not just others against Christians. It's between all sorts of religious groups, and not just religious. There's racial and social and tribal as well issues. But across the board, that's the biggest one. Across history, the biggest one is war. If you take it back, years, that's what's been the biggest driver of people having to leave home and go somewhere else.
So it's worth noting, because, you know, I guess you would think when you think persecution, you think, well, there's been a war and the people are fighting, but war is a whole nother category. This is, you know, that first category is persecution without, not in a war situation. Mm. So there's all this quiet persecution going on, you know, that is the biggest cause. That will surprise people, I imagine.
Mm. Yeah, it surprised me when I looked at it that was the broadest category, and that's in current times. That's not kind of going back too far into history. Hunger's a big one. People moving just to survive is another big one. You can go back into the biblical times and you'll see that's one of the big drivers even for Israel. What happened with them, you know, having to move around from time to time. And then climate change is another new big one that's coming on, and I can see some huge issues in that area coming up. Because one of the problems we face right now is that everybody's stuck within a kind of a political boundary, you know, geographical boundary. But what happens if half of Bangladesh goes underwater? Where are those people going to go?
Mm.
What happens when they start having to move across borders to find somewhere? Are those neighbouring countries going to be willing for that? If you know, Bangladeshis are Muslims and Indians are Hindus, are they going to let that happen? We saw a bit of that from the other side of the country with Myanmar and the Rohingya people, you know, and moving back into Bangladesh. And so, yeah, when they have to move, what's going to happen? How's that going to happen? When there are these geopolitical boundaries that can't be crossed, how do we cope with it?
And of course, the prediction is that climate refugees is going to be a fast growing category.
It's the fastest growing category. Mm. Some of the Pacific Islands, for example, where are all those people going to go when the whole island is under threat? I mean, they're already dealing with some of that now, with you know, into Fiji and being able to keep them within the Pacific. But here's a statistic as well. I mean, you know, one of the issues with refugees, we hear a lot about it, is people from Africa going across into Europe, trying to cross there, and you hear these tragedies of whole boatloads drowning.
Mm.
Well, there's going to be 1 billion people born in Africa in the next 20 years. Think that one through in terms of where are all those people going to go?
Yeah, into economies and climates that can't sustain them.
So what African countries have got strategies to cope with that? Like infrastructure, schools, hospitals, sewage systems. Where are they going to go? And what's going to happen when those 1 billion young people decide they want to move?
Let's get political.
Oh, no, Fraser.
So accepting refugees from other parts of the world is a political issue. It's divisive.
Hmm.
What would you say to, you know, a New Zealander and an American or a Brit or a Canadian who is a little bit uncomfortable about receiving refugees? What do you think our responsibility and our response should be? Let's put it in a New Zealand context.
Well, I think what you've got to do, if you're a kingdom person, you can't think of it like you're a Kiwi or a Canadian or an Aussie. You've just got to stop thinking that way. That's one of the problems. A lot of Western Christians, I think, are not processing well at the moment. What would Jesus do? You know, it's like, is this a gospel issue? If this is a gospel issue, then let's open the doors. See it as opportunity, not as a threat. You know, I think that we have to get serious about that. And it just seems ridiculous to me in New Zealand, where we don't have enough people. Really? Well, they all seem to be going to Australia, but you know, we're short of workers, and we're taking in, you know, nowhere near what we could do to.
I mean, I know, you know, I've got a buddy here in Christchurch who works with refugees. He is Egyptian, and he works with mainly Middle Eastern refugees. And he said, you know, you've got people coming here from, let's pick a place like Saudi Arabia, and he said, you know, they would never be able to engage with Christianity there at all. And they come here as whole families, and they're curious. And you know, where people are reaching out to them and showing them the love of Christ, you know, the opportunity to reach people here is so much greater than the opportunity to reach them in their home countries. But then if these people are able to return, yeah, you open up a whole different perspective, a whole different mission field.
Yep.
It's an extraordinary opportunity.
Oh, huge. And there are a lot of people here that are... you know, taking that opportunity and doing quite well with it. But as individuals, and if you talk to some people, you find a lot of resistance to outsiders, and we just got to get over that, because you don't have to start reading the Bible for many chapters before you start seeing how God started to use refugees, and he's done it all down through history. And he hasn't stopped. You know, it takes faith eyes to see the opportunity. When we react out of fear or preserving our own way of life or from a nationalistic point of view.
Well, we've got real problems. I think a political. We take a political response to it, perhaps rather than you know, kingdom response to it.
And part of the problem for us Westerners is that we allow our perceptions, our perspectives to be shaped by non-kingdom values on this. We're watching too much media, or we're watching extreme stuff, or it's just got to get back to, you know, what's God's heart for the refugee? Answer that question, and has it changed since Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers?
So, as always, folks, complaints to podcast at brighthopeworld.com. If you think we've got a wrong take on this issue, we'd love to hear from you. And you know, we might perhaps revisit this at another point if people say, no, this is a terrible idea to bring in people from other religious backgrounds. They're going to change our country and turn it into something we don't like. Maybe. Let's have a discussion about it. But
that's for, there's some fantastic verses in Acts chapter 17. Paul's talking, you know, in Athens to those people that had the unknown God, and he talks about how God is in control of the boundaries of nations and the times. And I think, wow, that's just so relevant for us today. What have we got to worry about? God's in control. In a sense, it's his problem. Let's just get on his team and start working with him.
And it has been something he did throughout Scripture, move people when people need to be moved.
Well, it wouldn't be a church unless persecution had come. You know, the first one we talked about in terms of the causes. It wouldn't be a church outside of Jerusalem if Paul hadn't, well, Saul hadn't come on scene and started beating up on the Christians and chasing them out, and they all, you know, just gossiped the gospel wherever they went, and before long there's churches all over Europe, and the rest is history.
Gossiped the gospel. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
That's a good T-shirt. Okay, let's talk about the areas where we are involved. So let's move away from refugees coming here. Where are we involved? Where do we have partnerships? What are we seeing?
Yeah, we've got a number of over time. We've had several engagements with refugees, and again, some of them are really really interesting in that you're dealing with the people at the point of their need and in a specific time, and you can't tell what will happen in 3 years on, 5 years on. I remember in the last season we talked to Bassam from Lebanon, and how he'd sort of said, you know, we asked him the question, is it dangerous for you to do what you're doing? And he said, well, it's too late. They can't do anything because so many refugees had come from Syria to Lebanon, and they'd become believers, and they'd gone to like 20-something other countries all around the world now as believers and as gospel gossipers.
That podcast is available on our website, podcast number 22. That's a good one. That's pretty awe-inspiring what that guy's doing.
Totally. And so, you know, we've had a couple of partners in Lebanon and Jordan that have been working with refugees. Probably the first big one we got involved with was with Manara in Jordan, and their vision was particularly for the Iraqi Christians just after old Saddam Hussein had left the scene, and a lot of persecution rose, so they were coming across in droves, and so for a number of years we were involved there with them. We're currently involved with the aftermath of refugees in Lebanon. A lot of them have come to Lebanon and now can't go back and can't go anywhere else. They're not registered with the UN, so they're stuck there long term. And that's the thing with a lot of refugees is they're often there for a short or medium term. If they've registered with the United Nations, they'll be in the neighbouring country for two or three, 5 years, and then they're moved on.
Which is tough as well. I mean, I know when we've talked to some of these folks, you know, when they are UN registered, they're not allowed to work. They're not allowed to go get a job. It's a pretty tough, you know, they depend on handouts, basically. It's a pretty tough space for them to be. And I think it'd be fair to say that, you know, in the countries where we connect with them, the church has really seen, wow, these people need help. And, you know, they do it out of love, but it is also an opportunity to share the gospel with people that may not have heard it.
Yeah, totally.
Albeit that a great number of the people who are refugees are Christian, but not all of them.
Not all of them, no, absolutely. And so we've been involved in the past in Italy. There were, for a long time, a lot of people, migrants particularly, were coming out of the Middle East and the Far East through Italy, but then with the Syrian situation, that really boosted up. And we were involved there for a number of years. We're not there now. We're currently working with in Egypt with some of our partners with refugees from Syria, Sudan, Yemen, Eritrea, Kenya, some there from the Congo. And interesting, you know, Uganda has probably more refugees than any other country, because they've been getting them from South Sudan. And in fact, they call Uganda the friendliest refugee kind of country to come to. They've been very hospitable to refugees from South Sudan and the DR Congo.
Which is extraordinary, really. I mean, you think of the strain that puts on their economy, the supply of food. You know, likewise in Jordan, is, you know, I think about 40% of their population are refugees.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a country that's very short of natural resources and has a high level of unemployment. I think about 45% unemployment in Jordan. And yet they continue to take refugees. I mean, it's an extraordinary
huge cost for those countries. And that's what's happening in Uganda. I mean, we've noticed in the last 5 or 6 years, as they've been getting them from those two different directions, the food costs, for example, in Uganda go through the roof, because you know, the NGOs are buying up all the food to take, you know, to put into the refugee camps, and so that means the local people are paying more for their food. And so lots of situations like that. And interesting, I was just in Pakistan and some of our partners, we met some of our partners, or the people from within the partnership we're involved with there, living in Pakistan from Afghanistan. And that was quite moving, just to spend a couple of hours talking with them and hearing their stories, the fact that they'd been beaten and put in prison and I had to hop in a car and drive across the border and would love to be back home, but I just don't know what life is going to be like for the next few years. And they're not in a particularly friendly country either. And even ethnically, they're a completely different ethnic group. Language, the different language, religion, different religion. And they have to kind of reestablish themselves as outsiders. And, you know, he was saying, oh, I'd love to go back, but I've got a 5-year-old daughter. I've got a 7-year-old daughter. If I could go back, would I take them back? You know.
Let's drill down on that just a little bit before we wrap up. Pick one of our partners that has been a refugee, and we've got a number of them.
Yeah.
Share something about what is the experience.
I can't just pick one there, Fraser.
I know. Perhaps we'll do a follow-up session. But pick your favourite. Don't have favourites. But pick one that's been a refugee and just share a little bit about what their experience has been like.
Well, I mean, the overriding word that would come to my mind as I think about all of those people is the word trauma and how the trauma of having everything ripped away from you, being abandoned by your people. I mean, imagine, you know, you're a Kiwi, all right? You've been living here for, I don't know, 3 generations. What would happen if all of a sudden the government said, right, all Maori people have to leave New Zealand? How would they feel about that? Which is what happened to 60,000 Bhutanese people, where because they were believers, they were driven to the border by their government and told to leave. They're not wanted here anymore. Gone. What do you do? I mean, I used a radical kind of, an extreme kind of motif there, but how would you feel?
So you got to carry that in terms of the, you know, that sense of insecurity, surely.
Well, you don't have to talk to refugees, and I'm not talking about current refugees. I'm talking about those that maybe were kicked out 2 or 3 generations ago from there. There's still stuff happening in their minds and in their worldview and that's shaping their thinking today because of what happened maybe generations ago.
Mm.
I remember we had a couple to come to the area where we lived. They came from the Bosnian War, and they were one from each side of of the conflict there. And my parents actually got alongside them and mentored them and helped them and helped them settle in. And they're telling their kids stories from like 600 and 700 years ago.
Really?
Of the start of this conflict, you know, and it's like, and so I think about my friends that we're working with, our partners that we're working with, and the impact, the trauma that this has had on their minds and on their lives and their worldview and their perspective, and it's yeah, hugely influential having gone through this kind of.
Mm. So, and I guess as a response to that, you know, one of our partners in Uganda, who is himself a refugee, has been from several countries, is now, you know, working, doing some trauma counselling with refugees, which is a first for us.
Yeah.
But recognising that that need is chronic.
Yeah, huge. And we were there at the end of last year with and listening to some of the people that he and his wife had counseled, and they said they couldn't believe the help that the trauma counseling had been to them, especially for two reasons. One is because they were coming at it from a Bible perspective, and so they were able to get to issues like forgiveness and all of that, but also because this was their story too, and so they were. So those two things made a very powerful response or tool for these more recent refugees.
We're going to need to call it to a close. But I mean, that's a nice sort of connection with the humanitarian thing. Is that, you know, an organisation like us is, you know, we're pretty practical, we're pretty kingdom, big picture. But sometimes it comes down to one of our partners, you know, sitting over a cup of coffee and helping someone process. Their trauma. That's the humanitarian side, because you know, it comes down to a very micro level as well.
Yep.
You know, that one person, that one family that is struggling.
Totally. Yeah. And we could never do that from outside.
No, we could not.
And it's a real kind of incentive for us to keep doing things the way we do, is finding local people that have these solutions to the issues of their people and coming alongside that vision that they have.
Well, we'll need to wrap it up there. Thank you, Kev. It's a really interesting area. There's so much more that we could say about these partnerships. You can go and look up most of them on our website. Some aren't there because of the sensitivity of them. But if anything we've said today has spurred your interest, please do send us an email, podcast@brighthopeworld.com, or you can comment on our Facebook site, facebook.com/brighthopeworld. We will be back again, probably a couple of weeks, I think, and we'll talk about our next category, which is orphans and vulnerable children. It's also, that's a big one, that's a tough one as well. But for now, any final thoughts, Kev?
We've often been asked at Bright Hope, well, you guys should be writing a book about some of this stuff, and we're reluctant to do that. It's part of the reason we're doing the podcast, I think, isn't it? So we don't have to write the book.
Yeah, that's right.
but I'd love to write some of the stories of the partners that we have who were refugees and who are now doing ministry. I think to do that would be pretty cool, and I think there'd be quite a few lessons for us to learn around how to respond to grievous kind of things that are happening to us as well, and learn some things from their stories. So,
well, once that $1 million advance arrives, we'll get right onto it. Hey, folks, as another train scuttles past the Bright Hope World office, which you may hear in the background, we will leave you for today. Thank you for joining us here on the Bright Hope World podcast. It ain't that simple, mate, and if there's one thing that is certainly true of any work in this space, it is certainly not that simple, mate. We're very fortunate to have great partners. But for Kevin and myself, thanks, and we will catch you next time.